I love Devon Alliance Church. There's a number of reasons why I love Devon Alliance Church. One of them is your sense of humor. A few years ago, I was, in passing, may have made comment about my dislike of Brussels sprouts. And promptly, days later, I had a bag of those green things hanging on my door. A couple years later, I made another comment about Brussels sprouts, and people started handing my wife recipes on how to cook Brussels sprouts. I loved that. Well, coming into Christmas, I made a comment. I asked, what are you hoping for Christmas? And I told a story about the year that I hoped for. Some of you may remember. Rock'em Sock'em Robots. Well, this week, someone handed me a bag. Oh, no, go ahead. No, you got the wrong slides in there. That's not going to work. Keep going. I'm hoping. No, one. That's the wrong set of slides. You're going to go without slides this morning. Okay, because that's the wrong church is in there. If you can try to look in the list, it'll say Philadelphia. Anyhow, I got a box or a bag handed to me Sunday morning, and in it was a little set of Rock'em Sock'em Robots. So now I have them on my table in my office. Thank you so much. It took a lot of years, about 40 or 50 of them almost, but I've got my Rock'em Sock'em Robots. In all seriousness, there we go. See? Thank you to the Alders family for, filling that void that existed for far too long. I'll remember those just like I remember my plaid pajamas that I received that year instead. We're going to go on with our series this morning. If you have your Bible with you, I invite you to turn to Revelation chapter 3. I almost said Philadelphia chapter 3, which you'd have a hard time finding in your Bible, but we're going to that church this morning in Revelation chapter 3. From all accounts, ancient Philadelphia was a rough place to live, an unsettling place to live, not because there was some sort of gang warfare or drug culture, but because of what it was built on and what it was built next to, in geographical terms, geological terms, actually. It was built next to a volcanic cliff, and it was built upon some shifting tectonic plates that kind of resulted in earthquakes that went on and on and on. Earthquakes and aftershocks. It was such a normal pattern of living, this quaking and shaking, that some compared it to living on the coast and getting used to the tide coming in and going out and how you get used to this pattern of living. That was what they got used to in Philadelphia. Life was always shaking, literally the ground beneath you tremoring. And yet people still moved there. And they did it for a couple of reasons. One was because the soil there was capable of producing some unbelievable crops. So people flocked there and dealt with the shaking. It was also right on a major trade route. It was called the Gateway to the East. It was on the route that led from Rome to the Far East. And so people wanted to be there for a number of reasons. It wasn't a thriving economic place, but it was a place of incredible influence. And that went right back to the founding of the city. It was a Greek city, and it was built right on a border. And it was strategically launched, planted, whatever word you want to use for starting a city. It was strategic from day one in that they wanted it to be I'll use the word missional city, in that they wanted it to be a place where Greek culture, Greek values, Greek way of life would not only take root, but spread out. And it adopted that kind of missionary mindset, except that what they were spreading wasn't the good news of Jesus Christ. It was a Greek way of life. It was part of their DNA from day one. We will hold dearly what we value, but we will also seek to spread it to those around us. And so it's not surprising, I guess, that Philadelphia became a bit of a missional city when it came to the early church. It was part of their DNA. That which you held dearly, you wanted to spread. Well, that was Philadelphia. It's the letter that we're coming to this morning, and its story begins in verse 7 of Revelation 3, so follow along. These are the words of him who's holy and true. Two words there, holy and true. Those words are used throughout the Old Testament. I read one stat, I think it was holy used like 450 some times in the original language. And every time it's linked directly back to God. So when Jesus is making this statement, it's an audacious, it's a bold statement. I am the one who is holy and true, holy in character, holy in his words, holy in his actions, holy in his purposes, uniquely set apart from anyone and everyone. Holy, true. The Greek word for true is real. In a city that was home to countless shrines dedicated to false gods and goddesses, Jesus says, I am the real deal. I am the authentic one. I am the one who was holy and true. Carry on. Who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut. What he shuts, no one can open. I read that and went, okay, where's that coming from? What does that have to do with anything? What's this holding keys thing? Well, it points back to Isaiah chapter 22. And if you're taking notes, that'd be a passage to read later. It's an interesting little story. Assyria has invaded Judah, but instead of trusting God to deliver them, the people of Israel, under the leadership of a man by the name of Shebna, goes looking for help from Egypt. So you got the picture? God's people are in trouble. Instead of looking to God, they look to Egypt. And God orchestrates things so that Shebna, the one who's leading them to look for help in the wrong direction, is removed, and the keys of authority are handed to a man by the name of Eliakim. And it's the fulfillment of a prophecy that Isaiah makes two chapters earlier in Isaiah 20. Listen to it, and you'll see the connection. In that day, I will summon my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I'll place on his shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut. What he shuts, no one can open. So it's a picture, isn't it? Eliakim held the keys of authority. He was given those keys, but it was only for a limited time. Jesus is saying, take that picture of authority. I hold the keys. Not just for a season, for eternity. Do you see the picture of Jesus that's being painted? It's an amazing self-portrait. I am the unparalleled, authentic, everlasting authority of this world. I hold the keys. What I declare is open, no one can shut. What I declare is shut, no one can open. I'm in charge. Well, that's quite the introduction to a letter, isn't it? I'm in charge. If I got your attention, let's lean in, Jesus says. I know your deeds. See, I've placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know you have little strength, yet you kept my word and not denied my name. This is one of two of the seven letters where Jesus doesn't deliver a rebuke. It's only positive. He says he knows four things about the people of the church of Philadelphia. Four things. He knows they have an open door. He knows they have little strength. He knows that they keep his word and that they won't deny his name. Four things. Wouldn't it be great if Jesus said that about us? I know four things about you, Devon Alliance Church. Four things. You have an open door. You have little strength. You keep my word, and you won't deny my name. I'd love that to be true of us. Well, let's take a look at a couple of those things. The open door, there's a couple of possible ways to interpret that, and both of them fit. It could be that Jesus is referring to the door of salvation. There's an open door of salvation. Through his death and resurrection, Jesus opened that door, the door by which we find peace with God. And that image would have been particularly meaningful to the believers of Philadelphia because the moment that they decided to follow Jesus, the door to the synagogue had been slammed in their face. So Jesus is saying to them, that door may be closed, but the door to God himself is wide open. The door to your local synagogue, they may not let you in, but because of what I accomplished, you have access into the very presence of God himself. that earthly version, the synagogue, was intended, built to represent access to God. And Jesus says, I'll do one better than that. You have access to me. See, standing before you is an open door. Well, there's another explanation to it, and you'll see the two of them fit together. Because it's not only a door of salvation, it's also a door of opportunity. If you read through Paul's writings, it's a term he uses quite frequently. I'll give you just three examples. 1 Corinthians 16:9, he says, I'll stay in Ephesus until Pentecost because a great door for effective work has opened for me. Door of opportunity. 2 Corinthians 2:12, when I went to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ, a door was opened before me in the Lord. Colossians 4, pray that God may open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ. So there's this idea of a door of salvation, but there's also this door of opportunity. And Jesus is saying to these believers in Philadelphia, synagogue doors closed, you have access to me. Don't stop there. You now have a door that's wide open before you to take that message to everyone around you. We have a door. It's wide open. But Jesus also says, not only do they have an open door, they have little strength. Put those two together. Open door. Great opportunity. Little strength. That sounds like it's a problem, doesn't it? Great opportunity. Little strength. It's not a problem. And I want to help you see how. Do you remember last week we were talking about what Jesus said to the church of Sardis? You're dead, he said to them. Do you remember why they were dead? I used the image from John 15 about the vine and the branches. They had separated themselves from their life source. When you stay connected, you have life. When you're not connected, you don't have life. Right? That was the message. Hopefully you remember it more than just the rock'em sock'ems. But that was the message from last week. Here's how that fits with this situation in Philadelphia. Jesus has said, here's a door of opportunity. I've placed it before you. It's wide open. You don't have the power to seize the opportunity. Given their circumstances, that makes a lot of sense. In Philadelphia, they weren't facing the degree of persecution that they were in Smyrna, where people were being martyred. But they were facing continual financial, relational pressure, synagogue doors being closed, persecution from those who said that they had joined some sort of strange cult following Jesus. They were facing opposition, and life was not easy. And I don't know about you, but when life isn't easy and you're facing an opposition, in this case persecution, there's something internally that says, I need to withdraw. I need to find a safe place. I need to pull it all in, gather the troops, rally the horses, whatever image you want to use. I need to find somewhere safe where I can start to feel a little bit more confident and secure. That was happening in Philadelphia. Jesus says, don't withdraw, advance. Why? Doors open. Doors open, the idea is you're supposed to go through it. If a door's closed, you should stay inside. But if a door's open, come on in. Walk through it. Jesus says, don't withdraw. Move forward. The door's open. I know you don't have strength to do it on your own, but I'm not asking you to do it on your own. If you stay connected with me, you have life. You have strength. You have everything you need. If you don't stay connected with me, your little strength will soon become no strength. But if you stay connected with me, the little that you have will be enough to do what I've called you to do. Let me say that again. If you stay connected with me, the little strength you have will be enough to do what I've called you to do. And if you're looking for a story that proves that, let me tell you one about a little boy with 5 loaves and 2 fish. the little strength we have will be enough to do what God has called us to do. The question is, will we use that little bit of strength to pursue God's purposes or our own? Right? If you have great opportunity and a little bit of strength, the question is, what am I going to use my little bit of strength to accomplish? In his book, Eye of the Storm, Max Licato tells a story. I read it years ago, but I was reminded of it this week. It's a story of a fishing trip that went south. It was one he took with his dad and his brother. And it went south not because, well, there were no fish, but because a snowstorm blew in. And they ended up having to hide out for a week in the back of a camper that was on the back of a truck. Sound like fun? Here's what he writes. When those who have been called to fish don't fish, they fight. When energy intended to be used outside is used inside, the result is explosive. Instead of casting nets, we cast stones. Instead of extending helping hands, we point accusing fingers. Instead of being fishers of the lost, we become critics of the saved. Rather than helping the hurting, we hurt the helpers. The next time the challenges outside tempt you to shut the door and stay inside, stay long enough to get warm and then get out. When those who are called to fish don't fish, they fight. I love that. The believers in Philadelphia were told, you have before you a great opportunity, and I've given you a little bit of strength. Will you use it wisely? I think that's a question Jesus continues to ask of every church, in every town, in every nation, in every corner of our world. I've placed before you an opportunity. You may be feeling overwhelmed by the opportunity that's standing before you, but will you use that little bit of strength you have to accomplish what I have in mind for you to accomplish? I'm challenged by that. I don't know if you are, but I am. Will you use your strength wisely? Not just as a church, but as individuals. We'll move on. We're going to come back to that. Trust me. Verse 9. I'll make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, even though they're not, but are liars, I'll make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you've kept my command and endured patiently, I'll also keep you from the hour of trial that's going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. If you were to flip back to chapter 2, a few stories earlier, to the story of the letter to the church at Smyrna, you'd recognize that phrase, synagogue of Satan, right? You heard that before if you've been tracking along with us. Synagogue of Satan was a reference to Jews who made life difficult for believers by making false accusations against them to the Romans. But you may also remember what Jesus said to that church about suffering. It was the church that was dealing with thalipsis, crushing pressure. Let me read it to you to refresh your memories. He said, "Do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you'll suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life." That's very different from what he just said to Philadelphia, isn't it? To Smyrna, he said, you're going to suffer. Your enemy's going to put some of you in prison. Hold on in the midst of the suffering. To Philadelphia, he says, since you've kept my command to endure patiently, I'll also keep you from the hour of trial that's before you. How does that make sense? Jesus commends both churches because they were faithful. And yet one suffers while the other is persecuted. In the end, both churches are going to be victorious, but their paths are very different, aren't they? That sound like a familiar question? It does to me. If God is fair and just, how does this kind of thing happen? How can two people who are both faithful, two groups of people who are both faithful, have such radically different experiences when it comes to suffering? How does the church of Smyrna, who are faithful, have to endure suffering while the church in Philadelphia, who are faithful, are kept from suffering? You ever ask that? David did in Scripture. I know I have. Why do righteous people suffer? Why do wicked people seem to get blessed? God, this doesn't make sense from a human perspective. It just doesn't make sense. And in the case of these two churches, human logic suggests one somehow had to be better than the other. Philadelphia must have been more faithful. And yet that's not what the text says. Instead, we're simply told that if they obey Christ, they'll be victorious in the end. They'll take radically different paths to get to the end, but if they're faithful, they'll win in the end. And it's the same message we're given. From a human perspective, it doesn't make sense. The only way it makes sense is if you look at it from an eternal perspective rather than an immediate one. It's the only way it makes sense. And I won't suggest for a moment that it's easy or instinctive. But it's the only way it makes sense. If we remain faithful, we win. If we don't remain faithful, we don't win. The path towards the finish line may look radically different for you than it does for your mom seated 6 feet to your right. It might look radically different from Art than it does for Janet. It might look radically different for the person in that far back corner than it does from the one in the front row. But if we're faithful, we win. And Jesus says, be faithful. Trust me, he says. Be faithful. One more thought before I move on. When Jesus speaks of the hour of trial, he's speaking of a time that will test the spiritual allegiance of those who live on the earth. Are they in love with God or with the world? And in the immediate context, that reference would refer to Roman persecution that the Church of Philadelphia was about to face. See, about 30 years after they got this letter, the city was turned over to the Romans. The Greek ruler of the day knew he was about to die. He had no offspring to hand the city to, so he literally went to the Romans and said, "Here's the keys, it's yours." Life was about to become radically different for the people in Philadelphia. That's the immediate context. The broader context, well, Jesus is referring to the time of tribulation that will encompass the earth before he returns to establish his kingdom. As Christians, we believe he's going to return to take those who love him to heaven. The burning question is when? Before tribulation, mid-tribulation, after tribulation. This passage, it's one that suggests pre-tribulation. Those who hold to that teaching point to this one. Because Jesus said, I will keep you from, not I will preserve you through trial. We could get into that. We won't this morning. We'll just keep moving on. Because we could get there and be there for a long time. Verse 11, I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. Said earlier, the people in Philadelphia lived with earthquakes and aftershocks. Historians say it was such a problem that eventually people gave up on the idea of rebuilding. They simply built little shacks or they lived in tents. If you get that way after you've rebuilt your home a few times, what's the point? Well, they lived with that kind of instability. People had lost it all from an earthly perspective. And those who hadn't lost it all had learned to hold very loosely to what they still had. That happens when you live under the strain of constant loss. For the believers, there was another level of that loss because they'd lost relationships with family and friends. Barred from the synagogue, so they would have lost their spiritual support network. I was thinking of that network this week, every time a prayer chain would come. was thinking of Tim and Nolene Bunder and their little baby. And as things were getting a little bit rocky there, it was so good for them, Tim said, to know that there were people who would pray. These believers had lost that network. There was nothing there. That's the context of verse 11. I'm coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. That image of a crown, it's a reward for faithfulness, but it's also a symbol of all these people had left. They'd lost it all. The only thing they had left, only thing they had to cling to, was Jesus. They had no homes. They had no fancy chariots, no trust funds, no investments, no RRSPs. They had nothing. Nothing except that which was most important. They had Jesus. I read verse 11 and I hear the words that old chorus, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus," running through my mind. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim. Yeah. That's what verse 11 says. Hold on to what you have. Verse 12. The one who's victorious, I'll make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will they leave it. I'll write on them the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write on them my new name. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. In 17 AD, another earthquake hit Philadelphia. And the government of the day offered what we would call disaster relief. Their taxes were refunded. Huge bailout program was offered. And in an expression of their thanks to, by that point, a Roman emperor by the name of Tiberius, they decided to change the name of the city. Instead of calling it Philadelphia, many were calling it Neo Caesarea, meaning the new city of Caesar. Jesus knows that history and says, I've got another name change in mind. I will write on you the name of the city of my God, not just some Roman emperor. The name of my God, the new city, the new Jerusalem. That name will never be rocked by earthquake. That name will last forever. The verse also talks about a pillar. I'll make you a pillar. There was a tradition in Philadelphia and in other cities of that region that when a person who had served the state well passed away, when they had left behind a noble record of whether it's public office or philanthropy, the city would remember their contribution by erecting a pillar in one of the local temples. Think park bench. We put plaques on park benches. They erected pillars in the temples all around the region. Jesus says to the believers, hear this. The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Think that would have rung true for the hearts of the Philadelphia believers? I'm not just getting a name on a park bench. Somewhere where it's going to fall apart someday. I'm going to have a whole pillar. And not in a building that's going to be shaken by earthquake. No. A pillar in the temple of my God. Those who are faithful will be remembered in the only temple that will last. That's what Jesus is saying to them. And not just by those who visit the temple on occasion. They'll be remembered by the one the temple's been created for. They'll be a pillar in the temple of God. How's that for a reward for those who had lost everything? And remember who said it. the unmatched, unparalleled, authentic God who holds the keys. That's a promise. So what can you take from this letter that applies to us? I think there's a lot. But throughout the week, I've been stuck on two questions. And the first one is one that you heard in a song. I think it was the second one we did this morning, which was unfamiliar to many of you, but you'll recognize it as soon as I say it. The first question is, what are you holding on to? What are you holding on to? If you were to make a list of 10 things you're holding on to, even in the last 7 days, I wonder what that list would include. What are the things you've been holding on to? Your list would probably have obvious answers like faith and family and friends. But once those three have been taken care of, what's next? If you take your cues from the world around us, you're probably holding on to toys. Our world holds on to toys. When they're little, the toys are little. When you get bigger, the toys get bigger, but they're toys. Things you can buy. Patrick Morley, an author, he says, many people are consumed by the desire to buy things they don't need with money they don't have to impress people they don't like. We hold on to toys. Others hold on to image. You say, not me. Does it matter to you if anyone likes your Facebook post? We hold on to image. We want people to like us. Social media feeds that hunger for popularity and for reputation. And even if what's behind the screen doesn't match with what's in front of the screen, well, that doesn't matter. All we care about is image. That's true for some. What are you holding on to? It's a question that challenges us to consider where we're placing our confidence, doesn't it? What am I holding on to? And it's a question that pops up at the most inconvenient moments in life. You ever notice that? It's all fine and good for me to ask it on a Sunday morning when you're warm and comfortable in church. What are you holding on to? I know the Sunday school answer, so Jesus. That's the Sunday school answer. But when life starts to shake beneath your feet, what do you hold on to? What do you hold on to? I believe that's one of the most common things we hold on to as Christians is blessings. Let me explain this a little further. Not the blesser, we hold on to blessings, the things God does for us. And I think it explains why we struggle with a question I asked a few moments ago about the church of Smyrna having to face so much struggle and the church of Philadelphia being set free from it. When a good person struggles, we ask, how's it fair? When a wicked person is blessed, we ask the same thing, how's it fair? It seems like a reasonable, logical question to ask. But if I'm honest, and I'm talking about me, not you, so me, if I'm honest, when I ask that question, there are times I ask it because I'm feeling ripped off in life. Why does that guy get better stuff than me? Why do they seem to be blessed and I have to struggle? I ask it because I'm feeling a little bit ripped off in life. And on the surface, it sounds like a fairness question, but if you dig a little bit deeper beneath the surface, it's really a what am I holding on to question. It's a where am I looking for contentment from question. How am I trying to find fulfillment in life question. What am I holding on to? And since I don't like being the only uncomfortable person in the room, I ask you. What are you holding on to? And here comes the second question. You'll see how they're connected. What are you going to do with the open door? We live in an age of unparalleled change. We all know that. A time where everything seems to be up for grabs. Truth is now viewed as subjective, and apparently there's no such thing as moral absolutes. That's what we're told. That's what we live with. And I'll be honest, there are times when I find that really intimidating. Times when I think of some of the questions that I face as a pastor where it's easy to say, oh, where can I hide? Because I don't want to have to deal with that one. Ever felt like that way? There's a temptation to say, oh, Lord, please come quickly. Because I don't want to deal with this is the other part of that statement, which we may not say. Yet, in reality, are things any different from what the Church of Philadelphia faced? They were mocked and ridiculed for their faith. People looked at them and said, we don't believe what you believe, will you just be quiet? They had doors closed in their faces. There were some who had thought they had completely fallen off the rocker, and it was even family and friends who disowned them and didn't want to talk to them anymore. And they were tempted to retreat in a safe corner and wait for things to improve or for Jesus to return. I've met Christians who are that way today. And yet Jesus said to them, look, you have an open door. And I believe he says the same thing to us. We have an open door. You will have skeptics. You will be rejected. You'll be tempted to withdraw because you don't feel you have the strength to face it. But guess what? Jesus says, I already know you're weak. I know you have little strength. That's why I gave you my Holy Spirit. Stay connected. You'll have all the strength you need to accomplish what I've asked and called you to do. So step through the door. You're not alone. Here's how those two questions are connected. What are you holding on to? When life starts to shake, what do you hold on to? What do you cling to? What do you grab onto? Is it Jesus or is it something else? Part two. Is what you're holding on to helping or hindering you from walking through the open door? Is what you're holding on to helping or hindering you from walking through the open door? I want to suggest you make a list of, I'm going to say, 5 to 10 people you know who've not yet walked through the door of salvation. 5 to 10 people, pull out a paper, write it down even now if you want. A list of 5 to 10 people who've not walked through the door of salvation. Their names are not yet pillars on the kingdom of our God. And then I'm going to invite you to ask God to open the door of opportunity for you to talk to them. A few years ago, I had a table up here with a bowl, and I asked you to put names in it and asked you to pray for the person. Some of you remember that. There's no table. There's no bowl this morning. Because I'm going to ask you instead to be honest with God about what you're holding on to and if it's hindering you from walking through the door of opportunity that he's placing before you. Is it fear? Fear over losing your reputation, your image? Fear over the way that family or friends might look at you? That's something big that people hold on to that keeps them from walking through an open door, isn't it? Lack of knowledge? Intimidation? Pride? Well, what's keeping you from walking through the open door? When it feels like the ground you're standing on starts to shake, we all look for something to hold on to. People in Philadelphia did, so do people in Devon. If it starts to shake financially, we look for something to hold on to. If it starts to shake in terms of our health, we look for something to hold on to. If it starts to shake relationally, we try to find something to hold on to. We all know what it's like. When life starts to shake, we grab for something. What is it you grab to? If it's not Jesus, the story of Philadelphia says it's not going to work. It's not going to last. And when life starts to shake and you're holding on to something, does that something help you be more obedient to God or keep you from obedience to God? Those are two questions I take out of that letter. If there's others that God puts on your heart, I invite you to wrestle with them. I've been fighting with these ones all week long. Maybe you will too. Let's pray.